Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Nicole Quinn, and I'm here with Dr. Daylon James, co-host of the Stem Cell Podcast. Welcome to the Lab Coats and Life Podcast, where we help scientists thrive. The Lab Coats and Life Podcast is brought to you by Stem Cell Technologies, a global biotechnology company supporting life sciences research and fostering communication and collaboration in science. If you enjoy the Lab Coats and Life Podcast, rate us and leave us a review. You can also suggest ideas or recommend guests for new episodes. Today, we have Dr. Richard Sever from Cold Spring Harbor on the podcast to talk about his experience in open access publishing. Richard Sever is an assistant director of Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory Press in New York and co-founder of the preprint server BioArchive. He also acts as an executive editor for the Cold Spring Harbor Perspectives and Cold Spring Harbor Protocols journals. After receiving a degree in biochemistry from Oxford University, Richard obtained his PhD at the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, UK. He then moved into editorial work, serving as an editor at Current Opinion in Cell Biology and later Trends in Biochemical Sciences. He subsequently served as an executive editor of the Journal of Cell Science before moving to Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in 2008. But before we get to that, are you enjoying listening to the Lab Coats and Life podcast? Are there other soft skills, topics, or questions about your life in a lab coat that you'd like to learn more about? Visit www.stemcell.com/suggest-topics to tell us what you're passionate about, and we will endeavor to cover it via Stem Cell Technologies mentorship resources. If you fill in the Suggest a Topic form before the end of August, you'll be entered into our latest Lab Coats and Life lab coat giveaway. That's www.stemcell.com/suggest-topics.
All right, Dr. Sever, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Lab Coats in Life. It's a unique format for me, but I'm really excited about it because moving outside of my wheelhouse of, you know, strictly stem cell science, I actually get to talk to scientists and leaders in the field who have moved the needle. In one way or another, that can really help trainees and all scientists. So I'm really excited to have this chance to talk to you about your input and your impact in the field. And I don't want to, you know, steal your thunder there. Why don't you explain in your own words what your research focus and just general focus and impact in the scientific field is?
Thank you very much for inviting me to be on. I'm one of those people who left the lab pretty soon after doing a PhD. So most of my sort of working life has been as an editor of journals, and I worked on several of them. But most recently, I think what I've been spending a lot of my time on has been preprint servers, and specifically the preprint server BioArchive, which, you know, now has a sibling MedArchive, but it's kind of an opportune time to chat with you guys because we just celebrated our 10th anniversary, and it's kind of interesting looking back. You know, I think there's quite a few people who didn't think we would ever get to 10, so, you know, it's a nice time to chat and of course a celebration, really.
Richard, I have to say I went to the AAAS meeting. I think it must have been 2016 or 17. And I'm not sure if it was you that I saw or one of your co-founders of BioArchive, but there was a big panel discussion about open access and preprints. And it was the first time I'd ever heard of a preprint. And I remember hearing of this, and of course I called it BioXRiv or something. It's like, I'm sure you get a lot when I first saw it. And I was one of those people who was like, I hope it works, but I don't know if it's going to. So congrats on 10 years. It's made a huge impact to the way science is communicated. And I'd love to hear, you know, maybe just give us a little walk down memory lane. How did this start? What were some of the milestones and hurdles along the way? And maybe just like a quick, you know, where are we now with BioArchive and MedArchive? And how is it sort of fitting into the scientific communication landscape?
Yeah, well, I mean, where are we now? We have more than 250,000 preprints across BioArchive and MedArchive. So that's a sort of nice landmark to pass on after 10 years. How we got there is it's been an interesting journey. And as I said, it's been a journey that, you know, sort of you couldn't necessarily have kind of forecast how things would have gone. I mean, one thing that we could say is, you know, it's really important to remember that bioarchive was predated by archive in physics and sort of computational science and math, and they'd been doing it for a long time. You know, that started in 1991 with Paul Ginsberg, who launched archive. And there were a kind of a number of conversations over the years about, you know, could this be done in biology? Could this be done in medicine? And a lot of people said no. You know, that, you know, and it's kind of interesting to think about. And not only did people say no, people tried and they failed. And then we launched BioArchive in 2013. And it's kind of interesting to think about why it succeeded. I think one of the things that people had said in the past was biology is different. You know, it's, you know, physics produces these easily verifiable conclusions. It's you do your stuff, you write QED at the end. And biology is really messy. It's completely different. It won't work in biology. Everybody will just get totally confused. The field will disintegrate. And it was interesting talking to people like Paul, who said, well, these people don't know anything about physics. Physics is not easily verifiable. It's messy too. And we were lucky being in Cold Spring Harbor because we had people who'd been physicists who had become biologists. And so they were like, well, you guys are crazy. That you ought to be doing this in biology as well. It's no different. It will work here too. So I think there's that. And then there was a lot of fear about how journals might react. And I think that was for the individual users. People were worried, oh, if I put a preprint online, will suddenly all the journals say, well, we're not going to look at it. This is previously published. So that was a big fear. And that fear for some people continues to this day, even though in the interim, it became very clear that all the journals pretty much were like, yeah, not only are we fine with this, but we kind of have to be fine with this because the movement is growing. So, you know, I mean, I think that was, in terms of memory lane, the key thing for me was talking to these people who had been physicists and mathematicians and were now biologists. And they said, you know, you guys absolutely should be doing this. So that was a real turning point for me. You know, my colleague John Ingalls and I sort of talked more and more about this idea and decided to give it a go, and taking a lot of soundings from within the community. And we got a lot of kind of good reception, in particularly in the population genetics community. It was clear that they had been thinking about this too. And I think there's a sort of general level of dissatisfaction with science publishing that everybody hears about, and in particular, it takes so long. You know, people were, you know, you go to a conference and you hear somebody talking about work and you're like, wow, that's amazing. But then, you know, the paper would appear a year later. And, you know, I think people were just generally thinking, you know, with the World Wide Web, why does it have to be like this? And of course, the answer is it doesn't. And that you can decouple that, the making the information available, from the process of peer review, and that had all been kind of conflated in the journal world. So that's kind of how we started, and you know, a lot of scientists voted with their feet, particularly in genomics, evolutionary biology, computational neuroscience, and so there was a wave of those kinds of people got involved, started posting papers on BioArchive, and then, you know, there's a kind of like almost a kind of like osmotic process throughout the community. And, you know, somebody who's a stem cell biologist would say, oh, you know, I just read this kind of genomics paper about some aspect of development. And then you've got a lot of people in developmental biology and cell biology beginning to do it. And then funders beginning to say, hey, this is a good thing, and you should be doing this. And of course, that became most evident when we got to the pandemic. In the pandemic, by, you know, sort of luck more than judgment, we had launched MedArchive for clinical information 6 months before, you know, expecting that it would have a sort of slow growth like BioArchive did and ramp up over a number of years. And, you know, 6 months later, there were 10 million people looking at it every month, and we had 4,000 papers because, you know, everybody understood that, you know, for COVID work and understanding the virus, getting the information out really, really quickly was really important. So that became a real demonstration of the effectiveness. and you know, and a demonstration that it could work in medicine, because that was another thing. We MedArchive, we were intentionally came a number of years after BioArchive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't have a year to, I think a year is generous when you say it takes a year to publish. I think it's sometimes a lot more than that. And I've always lamented about how, you know, it takes so long to do the science, and then to actually get it out there takes forever. And you mentioned conferences, and, you know, we're lucky if we see something at a conference. Conferences are a pretty exclusive place to be as well. So, you know, really things were hidden for quite some time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just, I guess you underscored it there, both of you. It's the speed, right? The question being, why? Why do we need a preprint server? I think one of the major responses to that is that, yeah, it takes too long to get the stuff out. And I heard you in a talk you gave online talk about how Steve Quake at the BioHub had done some back of the envelope calculations and kind of came around to the idea that preprints can accelerate science roughly 5x over the course of a decade, right? And it's obvious why. It seeds collaboration, and also ancillary benefits, young scientists, visibility, there's no paywall on these preprints, right? So yeah, it seems like a no-brainer in terms of the why, and we've addressed that. But you know, there's the counter argument that I think a lot of people make about speed, also considered as like haste, or maybe the work is a little bit less vetted or less rigor. It's more about just getting it out there, making the claim, than actually supporting it, right? So what are the I'm sure been a lot of haters out there who've been telling you why it's a bad idea or why it's going to fail or how it's going to lower the standard or whatever it is. What's your response to those, and do they have any now, years later? Is there any like evidence to point towards that they can say, you know, in the same way that it's difficult to say, hey, look, this science has been accelerated in the last 10 years by 5x. It's hard. We don't have a, you know, control there. When people say the reverse and talk about the muddying of the waters or the reduction of rigor, is anyone pointing towards any specific evidence, or are they all just saying this could happen? What are the arguments that you hear against the preprint?
Well, I mean, I think the noise is a concern. I think the possibility that there's information out there that is wrong is a concern. But, you know, I mean, my feeling is that that is already the case without preprints. You know, I mean, so with one anecdote that I think illustrates it perfectly is when we were planning MedArchive and launched MedArchive, I was talking to my dad, who's a, you know, a sort of older generation physician, about this. And he sort of said to me, you know, well, you know, and I get what you're doing with BioArchive. I'm not sure about this MedArchive thing. I worry about, you know, the potential misinformation, wrong information that's coming out. I worry about this. We talked about it a little bit, and then he came back to me like about 3 weeks later. I spoke with him on the phone, and he said, oh, you know, I've been thinking about your MedArchive thing. I've decided it isn't a problem, actually, because all the crap gets published somewhere anyway. And, you know, and I think that's how you have to, I mean, that's, and it's a sort of, it's flippant, and I don't want to seem like I don't care about this, but I do think we have to set it against the backdrop of the fact that, you know, you can now put any information on the web. So there's no way, you're not, by not doing preprints, you're not stopping things getting out. And not only that, you can pretty much publish anything somewhere these days. There's really been a race to the bottom with journal publication. So that, you know, I mean, I was just, there was a discussion on Twitter yesterday about this sort of dreadful paper that's appeared in a peer-reviewed journal, which everybody thinks is complete nonsense. There are lots of examples of that. So I think that already exists. And the good thing about a preprint is it comes with a massive sign on the front, basically saying this has not been peer reviewed. We're not making any claims about it at all. It could all be wrong. Yeah. So I think it focuses people's attention on this issue. But it's very transparent about that aspect. I mean, and I do find it hard to find examples of preprints that provide evidence that this is a problem. I mean, I actually find it quite easy to find examples of journal articles which purport to be peer-reviewed and are incredibly misleading. So I don't think so. And it's also worth emphasizing that at BioArchive and MedArchive, one of our major concerns was always that this might be dangerous, that some papers might be dangerous, and that if they were wrong, there could be bad consequences. And so we do all the paper, and people sometimes think we just put every paper we get online, but actually everything is looked at by a scientist. So there is, it's not peer review, but we look to see whether there's something that's potentially dangerous, particularly dangerous if it were wrong. So, you know, in those cases, we turn them away. So it's, you know, I think really the worry is that, you know, you might read a paper and think, oh, that's pretty good. And it might take you down the wrong direction experimentally. But a lot of the time people point out that the real thing with preprints is that they're being read for the most part by people who are perfectly equipped to peer review them anyway. I mean, we talked about conferences a few minutes ago. It's like a conference, but with 6 billion potential people in the audience. And most of the people reading preprints are, I mean, most of them are really arcane bits of science and biology or health science. And so most people will read them, will be experts, and will be equipped to evaluate them. And if they aren't, then they should ask somebody else. So I find it hard to point to specific instances where there's been a problem. And as I say, you know, we've always had this in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I want to elevate that point because I think that's something that's lost on many scientists that I've spoken to about preprints, is this idea that it's like a pretty much like a beefed up Twitter where everyone could just post whatever they think or whatever they've found, where in fact, there is a screening process. This is science. It's a scientific paper. And I think it's important to emphasize with the MedArchive in particular, that idea that that any kind of misinformation that might be exploited by bad actors is excluded from that process, where, as you said, I mean, sometimes you have peer reviewed journals that are happy to place that. So I just want to elevate that point to be clear. And also, though, to ask this question, you know, given the length of time that the archives have been around, including the original, but BioArchive, now Major Imprint, and many others, as each one of these preprint servers emerges, does it change the kind of the whole, like as you get the more niche preprints, does that take away from the pool in BioArchive at all? I mean, I know you're not reviewing all of these articles, the volume is too high, but have you noticed any kind of evolution in terms of the content, notwithstanding the volume, which has increased, but is the type of articles that are going to BioArchive are changing at all, in your opinion, or that you've seen?
Well, I mean, so what? There's a couple of ways in which it does change. One is that it's very clear that different disciplines adopt preprints at different rates. So what's interesting is when you look back at the original archive, that it started with the high energy physicists, and then the condensed matter physicists came later, and various other people. And there's still some areas of physics which are not huge adopters. And we saw something very similar with BioArchive. Initially it was mainly genomics and genetics, and then the sort of bioinformatics. But as I said, the developmental biologists came along, and then the cell biologists. So you do the population of papers is changing, but mainly because more people are getting on board in different subjects. I think there's also a discussion about, we find something like 70 to 80% of these papers go on to appear in journals. So the question is, what's happening with that other 20%? That 70 to 80% figure is calculated after 2 years. So some fraction of the 20% will appear in a journal. They're just at the tail of, I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier on, Nicole, that, you know, it can take more than a year. It can take, I mean, I've seen papers where the submitted and accepted date is 5 years. So some of them will be there, but there will be a class of paper that doesn't appear in a journal. And what are those? Some of them may be so bad that they never get into a journal. Some of them may be kind of, I don't think there's many like that. some of them may be papers where, you know, they morphed and they became part of something else. But some of them, I think, will be this category of paper where people say, I want to get this information out there. I'm done with it now. I don't need to send it to journals. It doesn't need to be peer reviewed. There's certain types of study where people say that's enough for me. It's out there for people to read. I'm not going to go through all the peer. It's not worth it for this information. And I think it's going to be really interesting to watch that fraction. And some people predict that could become 50% of papers. You know, if everybody becomes, you know, if we lose this obsession with the sort of branding and impact factor, there may, you know, you may have a lab where they say, look, half the papers, we just put them on bioarchive. The other half, we put them on bioarchive and then we send them to a journal because there's some reason that we need to go through the formal peer review process. And clearly during COVID, there was a certain type of paper where people were like, I want to get this out. I want to get it read fast. And by the time it could be peer reviewed, it's going to be totally out of date anyway. So we saw some kind of, and they were pretty variable quality. We saw some modeling of the epidemic. And, you know, you kind of get to a point where if you start modeling the epidemic in, I don't know, March of 2020, you know, how useful are those predictions if the paper is published in December of 2020? People may just say, you know, at this point. So I think that there'll be various reasons why there are some papers that never move on to formal peer review. And I think it'd be interesting to watch that. I mean, it's always interesting when I talk to scientists about the future of peer review and I say, you know, how many papers should be peer reviewed? And I get answers from 0 to 100%. Some people think that peer review is so broken and so wrong that we shouldn't do formal peer review of any papers. And other people think that, you know, absolutely every single thing should be peer reviewed, and that you know, the entire kind of field will disintegrate if they aren't. So it's kind of interesting. I think that'll be very interesting to watch over the next few years.
Just to add to your numbers there, there's also this other kind of paper maybe that I was interested in, this semi-superconductor thing, LK99, which came out on the bioarchive. And so I looked into it later. What I found is that there was a series of bioarchive papers that, you know, nucleated this massive effort across many scientists who ultimately, I wouldn't say debunked, but they showed that it wasn't a superconductor, and they explained why not and why the false result emerged. You know, they kind of like figured it all out completely outside of the sphere of peer review. It was a true peer review.
Yeah, no, I think that's the point. I think, you know, it's kind of interesting. So that paper was on archive because it's basically a physics paper, but we have had examples on bioarchive of people who have repeated other people's experiment. There was a great example by a former Cold Spring Harbor scientist, Yaniv Ehrlich, who Craig Venter had put a paper, published a paper in PNAS claiming that their group could predict your appearance from your genome sequence. And literally the same day that that appeared in PNAS, by the end of the day, Yaniv Ehrlich had posted a paper on bioarchive debunking that finding, and he showed that actually what they were really doing was predicting what the average ethnicity was of someone. But that was kind of, I mean, that was a real-time peer review. So I think one of the issues is, and it's funny, I wrote a big article about this for PLOS Biology on the history of science publishing recently, and a lot of people kind of, they talk about peer review as if, you know, sort of 300-400 years ago, when journals were invented, peer review appeared on day one and was practiced like it is today. But actually, it's a relatively recent invention. You know, the most journals only started doing it after the Second World War. And as you say, it's a sort of formal process that's been enacted. But actually, peer review is the repetition and the analysis over a period of time of work. That's really what peer review means. And so there is a possibility for preprint servers to do that, because people can replicate the work or fail to replicate the work and explain of what the problems were. And there have been a handful of sort of really great examples of on BioArchive where people have done that. Another one is, I don't know if you are familiar with the tardigrade, this sort of tiny little eukaryote. But there was a paper in PNAS that said it had huge amounts of horizontal gene transfer, the like of which had never been seen in a eukaryote. And within a kind of like a couple of months, there was a paper on BioArchive, which basically showed that this was completely wrong, and it was some form of contamination in the sequencing. And so that was the best form of peer review, really, as you say.
My notion of that was that tardigrades could, I thought you were going to say they couldn't survive in space. That's what I knew about tardigrades. So is that still valid? Because I'm really holding on to that one. That's important.
Yeah, I don't know. Chris Mason is a New York scientist who's done a lot of work on the epigenetics of space travel. So I'll have to ask him.
I have a few comments. There's so much in here. The first is going back to what you were saying about, you know, what percentage of papers should end up in journals. And you talked about the race to the bottom, and there's just more and more and more journals to the point of predatory journals that are just trying to publish these things. And I think you're right that I've always said, I wish there was a journal of negative results, like what didn't work. And there's not, because you have to have a certain amount of impact or a certain story to get into a regular peer-reviewed journal.
I think there actually is a journal like that, and what's interesting is people don't put papers in it because they don't think it will benefit their careers,
right? Which is ridiculous. I mean, maybe it won't benefit their careers, but the point is to benefit science, right? So we're trying to get out there so I mean, there's a huge amount of papers that could, you know, this didn't work, don't go down this road, it didn't, you know, that needs to get out there. And then I think you're also onto something there with the small pieces of information. I know with you know, how many little bits of information do you have that don't make it into that big paper that you end up submitting, that are still useful pieces of information that should be, you know, learned and used and built upon by other scientists. So, but I do want to talk a bit about the peer review, because you said, you know, there's this spectrum of perspectives of 0 to 100% of papers should be peer reviewed. And I would like to flip that question around and say, how much of your time, dear scientists, do you want to spend peer reviewing papers? Because it's a huge endeavor, right? And I know I don't peer review anymore, but back when I was doing research, I would actually kind of dread that invitation of, you know, can you peer review this? Not only because it was a huge time commitment, but because I felt an enormous amount of pressure to get it right, knowing that there's only a couple people that are going to be looking at this. Whereas on a preprint server, you're now doing this crowdsource review, right? So you now have what I would say is actually true peer review instead of a handful of selected people. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on the future of where peer review might go or should go. And then I have so much was gathering in my mind as you were talking, that the last little point there, you spoke about Craig Venter's publication getting into PNAS. And I think there is a little bit of, maybe not even a little bit, there's a lot of that where if you have a big name and a big lab and you're, you know, you're going to get into PNAS or Cell or Nature or something like that. And maybe we should be pulling back on that because we should all be, you know, subjected to the same scrutiny. So, but let's go back to the peer review conversation. I'm interested to hear where you think it should go. You know, what burden should be out there on scientists, and what is BioArchive the type of platform? Like, is that where we should be moving towards entirely?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The great thing about BioArchive is it doesn't constrain what you do next, because it decouples the peer review from the dissemination. I think that's where the opportunities are. I think, you know, there's a real a chance now for people to experiment and ask the question that you're asking, what should peer review look like? And I've always thought, I mean, there's a couple of things that immediately spring to mind. One is the fact that peer review looks pretty standard, whatever field you're in. You know, you send it to two or three people and an editor makes a decision based on, you know, basically nagging them for 14 days to say, get me a written analysis of this paper. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, back to what we were saying earlier about peer review, maybe maybe if the information's out on the preprint server, you have much more freedom, both in time and mechanism for peer review. You know, I always kind of think of, you know, for the examples of people doing synthetic biology and building tools, maybe the best peer review of those is somebody actually testing them in a lab. And you could have, and if the information's already out there, you have the freedom and time to do that, because you don't have to do it really quickly, because every day you delay is holding up the information out there, because it's already there. So I think that's kind of interesting. I mean, you talked about the burden of peer review. I mean, the other thing that I always note is that we have these kind of simultaneous problems at the same time, with lots of scientists saying, I'm so burdened with peer review, I'm asked all the time, peer review is broken, the system is overloaded. But then you have a whole, I mean, as a journal editor, many journal editors get emails from people saying, I would love to be asked to peer review a paper. I never get asked. So there's a lot of early career scientists who are never asked, who would love to be asked. There's lots of people outside Europe and North America who would like to be asked and never asked. So, I mean, that's another example of where you buy, I mean, it's not necessarily crowdsourcing, but being able to have a much, much, a much broader net cast could solve some of those problems, increase equity by involving more people, and get us to a point where we can do a better job and decide what exactly it is that peer review is doing. Because I think that's the other thing. I mean, I mentioned that article I wrote recently, but one of the key points of that article is that what we call peer review conflates a huge number of things. You know, there's the level at which the peer review is examining the science and saying, is this correct, or do I think it's correct? And then there's the kind of like, is this any good? Is this important? And then it becomes a filter of some sort. You can say, I only want to read the good papers, so I read the ones in certain journals because I believe the peer review system has put them there. And you realize, I mean, this is what's kind of interesting, is that there have been a number of studies that have shown that most papers don't change very much from being a preprint to being in a peer reviewed journal. And so, you know, the immediate thing is, well, you know, peer review is not doing anything. But it is doing something. I mean, people will argue whether or not it's a good thing. It's deciding what journal they go into. So even if the peer review doesn't change the paper, one thing it does is it decides what journal that paper goes into, which people use as a filter to read. And lots of people will dispute whether that's a good filter, but it absolutely is a filter that people use. So, I mean, again, that's something that we could look at and say, can we, now we've decoupled the dissemination and the peer review, can we deconflate aspects of peer review that around things like the quality of the article, as opposed to the level of broad interest, impact is a word that people throw around. And another point I always want to make is that there are other things that journals and preprint servers do that are important and will be increasingly important around verification of information. You know, we need to do a better job, and it's hard, assuring that this is the right person. You know, this person who wrote the article did write the article. The data in the article are bona fide data and are not kind of, you know, created by ChatGPT or the latest large language model or something like that. So there's all sorts of things that I think are not talked about enough, about the kinds of evaluation of content that are not quite peer review, but maybe increasingly important in a kind of that sort of whole post-truth world.
I want it, before Daylon takes it away, I meant to do this earlier, I want to direct our audience to that PLOS Biology paper that you just published, because I think it's a really comprehensive history of publishing and has some nuggets in there for food for thought on where things are going next. So thank you for publishing that and putting the effort into that.
I loved reading that. And I'm going to quote from the abstract, which I think was a nugget that, while it would seem to maybe be a disincentive to adopt the preprint idea and framework, it's not mutually exclusive. You said journal brand and impact factor. You were just talking about journal brand and impact factor have meanwhile become quality proxies that are widely used to filter articles and evaluate scientists in a hyper-competitive prestige economy. And I think that last point is what I wanted to focus on, is the hyper-competitive prestige economy kind of seems like zero sum, right? And that there's a disincentive, there's a loss to these, you know, up-and-coming or esteemed research with their big result. But it's not mutually exclusive, right? I think what we're talking about here is that you can get it out in a preprint, get your line in the sand, and then you're actually arguing that it still is important to review, and for like those legacy reasons of deciding as a proxy for impact and importance, which I honestly, I don't love as a scientist, but like it's how we all live and breathe, right? It's how we, you know, advance in our careers as scientists. We need, I'm afraid, and I would love to live in a world where we don't, but it seems like we need these proxies to judge ourselves in this hyper-competitive prestige economy. But it raises a question to me that with all the preprint servers that are coming out, also another thing I want to point to in that article, which I didn't know about, was just the idea, which I'm aware of, but I didn't understand the timing of how the big prestige journals, Nature, Science, Cell, kind of gobbled up all the more niche subject matter with their sibling journals, you know, the Cell Stem Cell, the Nature Medicine, Nature Biotech, to the point where now essentially the big three or big four, whatever you want to call it, they own all prestige science, which I think is a bit of a money grab on the publisher's side. I don't know why else they would do that, but it does raise the question that as a similar thing happens with the preprints, as you get these specialty preprints, is there ultimately going to be a point where you have your prestige preprint, where, you know, things that get into bioarchive are maybe at a different level of impact than whatever niche, or is it going to remain all comers in perpetuity?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I think that the one thing that we're, you know, I mean, one of the things that people sort of said to me early on was, and there are great papers on bioarchive. So it's interesting. They were like, and the papers are really good. You know, they're better than, you know, plus one or insert whatever dismissive remark that somebody's making. And I was like, well, I'm glad that there are great papers on bioarchive, but let's just be clear. The goal is not to have only great papers on bioarchive. The goal is to have all the papers on bioarchive and biology and medicine. So that means that on average, they'll be pretty mediocre, because most ones are. But what you do is you decouple that filtering. And so maybe you can make it better. Because the real problem that people, I mean, there's a number of problems that people have with, you know, this idea that if you get a paper in Nature, that you get a job immediately. You know, there's the kind of, you know, should those kinds of brands be used as the quality proxy? And there's a whole debate about that. But, you know, even if you don't have too much problem with the concept itself, you ought to have a problem with the fact that that decision is made really, really soon by the opinions of two or three people. And so, you know, even if you, you know, I mean, even if you don't mind that, and a lot of people argue about that, there is the problem that, you know, you have this kind of immutable quality indicator that is assigned before anybody gets to read the paper. And that stays, you know, that, you know, 20 years later, that's still a Nature paper. And people go, oh, well, it must be a great paper because it was in Nature. You know, even if for the previous 19 years, people have said that's garbage, you know, I don't know why it was published in Nature, it still has the word Nature. And so, you know, I mean, I think that's one thing we want to get away from. But as you say, I think people always want proxies, and that's one can't be naive about that. I mean, another thing that I think people need to be careful of is if you do get away from a sort of third party for objective proxies, for want of a better word, you have to be careful. So in that Craig Venter scenario, you mentioned Craig Venter gets the paper in PNAS, but if PNAS goes away, then you have to be very worried that people don't say, oh, well, it's a Craig Venter paper, therefore it's good. You know, I mean, that was one of the things that I, you know, I've talked about before is that we have that whole hyper-competitive prestige economy comes about because there's a real narrowing of the pipeline once you get up to permanent academic positions. So everybody is fighting for them. Everybody's fighting for grants. And that is why you have this prestige economy. So simultaneously, people are deluged with information. So they want signals. And if you remove the signal nature, people will find something else. And we should worry that they then say, oh, you know, this is a paper by Craig Venter, or this is from somebody at Harvard. So we have to be aware of those kinds of things. I think the question is whether through this decoupling process, by having more longitudinal assessments, we can get to a point where there are better ways and things that are more multidimensional. So rather than having a brand, you know, which I will, you know, I mean, it's kind of amusing to me that, you know, scientists, sort of value their objectivity, but they turn out to be just as suckers for brand as everybody who buys Nike trainers and wears Calvin Klein underwear. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, it's always interesting to me that whenever Nature launches a new journal, people complain about impact factors, but before it even gets an impact factor, everybody has decided that Nature X is the best journal in field X apart from Nature. And that happens immediately before they published any papers. And that's, you know, I mean, and they're very smart people in Nature. They have good editors, et cetera, and they've got a good track record, but it has built the brands to become very, very powerful. And, you know, we have to understand that that is a reaction and that's capitalizing on the academic career structure. And that's the one thing I always think we should be very careful not to lose sight of. Often people point the finger at publishers or journals, but actually they're just responding to this, the career pyramid and the structure of academia. And, you know, I kind of joke that, you know, 50 years ago, people didn't worry about which journal they got their article in because they were guaranteed to get a job anyway.
Right, right. I just, as the director of brand at StemCell, you just spoke right to my heart when you know, a brand is how people feel about you. And I'm always told by my scientist colleagues, well, scientists are trained to like not pay attention to their feelings. And it's really about the data. No, scientists also buy Apple products and Nike products. And
right.
You've given a perfect example, you know, our tie to Nature and Cell. And but stemming on that, I was just, you know, you spoke before to the fact that 70-ish% of papers on BioArchive end up in journals. So is it, maybe this is a really naive question, but if I have it, I'm sure somebody else does. Is it the case that the journals are now watching BioArchive, and if there's a paper that's getting a lot of traffic, comments, attention, are they now going and seeking out the authors and saying, hey, please submit, or like you're pre-approved, like a credit card, you know, if you've got good credit rating, you're pre-approved for X journal if you'd like to submit here, or I don't know, even waiving the exorbitant fees that come. Maybe I don't want to tie that into it, but is that starting to happen?
Yeah. And that is amazing. That happened really, really quickly. I mean, you know, we launched at the end of 2013, and very early in 2014, I remember being contacted by someone. I think it was a guy called Leonid Krugliak, and he sort of showed me an email that was basically said, oh, dear Leonid, we saw your paper on BioArchive. Would you be interested in submitting to redacted name of very high profile journal? And that happened very quickly. And of course, you know, I mean, bear in mind that Cell, Science, Nature have like loads of editors who go around to conferences, hearing talks, looking at posters, trying to find really interesting work and encouraging the authors to submit. So obviously they would do this. And I think that happened pretty quickly and is quite common. I think the challenge is that, you know, that's a very targeted approach by sort of smart editors who think this is good science. The other end of the spectrum is there are clearly predatory journals who basically will email everybody who posts on BioArchive saying, oh, I loved your paper, please submit. I mean, it's funny, we've all experienced this. I mean, because I'm not an active scientist, I don't publish papers that often. But, you know, the minute that I publish a paper like the one you mentioned in PLOS Biology, you know, within the next couple of days, I get an invitation to write a review on forestry or, you know, gastroenterology, all these sorts of things that I have no expertise in whatsoever, and serve to reveal the just how much of this is spam. I mean, an anecdote here, the funniest example we had was every now and then, like, you know, one in 100,000 or something like that, there'll be some instance where something goes wrong at BioArchive and it misfires and we have to remove something. And we actually got an email from a predatory journal that said, "Dear BioArchive, we were very interested in your paper, file removed because of technical error, and we would like to encourage you to submit to our journal," which I thought was absolutely fantastic.
That's amazing. I haven't published in 12 years, and I still get invitations to conferences and to be a postdoc in my lab that never existed. And, you know, I think we all have to be a bit scrupulous about that. But still, you know, back to the prestige of journals, if Nature came knocking after you put something up on BioArchive, that not only saves somebody a lot of time with the reformatting and all of the, like, you know, when you go down that journal train, if you can just put it in one place and say, let's see if somebody comes to us, that back to the time savings benefit of and the acceleration of science, there's a little piece there.
Yeah, I was just fondly remembering technical error because file removed. That was a real page turner. But no, seriously, we're thinking about this new forum, right, for, I guess, being exposed to research for editors. I wonder if, like, you know, whatever has a front has a back, as they say. And in the modern era of, like, I don't want to call it the gamification, but a kind of slight manipulation of people's feelings with algorithms and Facebook at its worst, right? But also on every level, I think the kind of the internet as a forum is something that magnifies some things and maybe obscures others. And there's no real direct correlation sometimes to whether or not those things have or do not have value. So I just wonder, and this follows an example that someone told me who remained nameless, who kind of gamed the BioArchive to draw attention to an article. And I've heard this is not like there's nothing unethical about it. But it just, I think it raises some questions. And in this case, the print went on, the preprint went up. There was a bit of an echo chamber around that because it was shared with, you know, people who were very much against the idea and also collaborators. And within that relatively small sphere of, let's say, 10 researchers, a ton of discourse was created. And that caught the attention of the editors at a major journal. And so they invited my friend, I'll call him, to submit. So I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but it just seems like in that system, you know, when I think of someone like myself who has zero social media presence and is like cringes at the idea of sharing anything because I assume that anything I think is fundamentally wrong, that, like, I would not be so, you know, outspoken online. And therefore, it becomes, I'll put it differently, it becomes a real important skill for the advancement of your science to be able to promote it, to self-promote. And I don't know that that's an idea that has not always been there in science, but I think it's a relatively new idea that, like, hey, you got to get out there, get it on the preprint, and then promote it. And then, you know what I mean? So I guess I don't know where the question is in there. I just want your thoughts about the idea of the science and the value of that science from the editorial standpoint being not so much about their own experience. And I think it's necessary, by the way, because these editors can't know everything, right? So you kind of have to cede if people are talking about it, it must be important. I just wonder if that changes the game and if you think that's a positive or negative change.
I think there are pluses and minuses. I mean, I think on the plus side, one of the things that, you know, social media, for example, do is, you know, they allow people to have a voice who didn't necessarily have a voice. You know, by one of the things I think that was key to success at BioArchive in part was because it kind of arrived at a time when there was a lot more peer-to-peer conversation. You could go, you know, I could like never met you before, but you could put your paper on Twitter and I could reply to you and say, oh, that's really interesting. But, you know, had you considered the possibility of this artifact in your phase separation section or something like that? That hadn't happened. I could also then, you know, sort of build some kind of reputation as somebody who thinks about this. And so people would follow me and say, oh, well, you know, he's kind of, he knows about this stuff, so I'll follow him, rather than having my interest dictated by who the editor had selected to write the News and Views articles. So, I mean, I think that's the other thing. So there's that. There is a downside. I mean, because, you know, the most awful aspects of social media are, you know, don't omit science. You know, science, the same things happen. That it's there are phenomena within social media which are terrible, and, you know, they manifest in scientific discussions. So that's a bit of a problem. But I think in terms of, I mean, you talked about sort of selling the work, marketing the work from individual. I mean, people do that an awful lot already, right? I mean, we have to, you know, I mean, many PIs spend their whole time going around the world, North America, giving talks to people. And, you know, I mean, I remember sort of, you know, talking to a friend of mine once who was saying, oh, I was like, oh, what are you up to over the next couple of weeks? He's like, oh, I've got to give a talk at Harvard, then I've got to give a talk at Stanford, then I'm off. And I'm like, you don't have to. You know, this is not like, you know, it's like you're doing this because you think that there is value, and there is, you know, and the altruistic and perhaps like naive perspective is that, you know, it's beneficial for these people to hear from you. You know, the more selfish thing is that actually, you know, this is sustaining my reputation as a thinker in the field. It allows me to market my opinions, and so, you know, I will say yes to every invitation to give a talk because that spreads my scientific brand around the country. So there's a bit of that anyway, and so, you know, I mean, I think, you know, that there are undoubtedly bad aspects, and some of the worst features of these social media platforms are manifest in science as well as discussions of, you know, football results.
Yeah, to your point, I think you were putting it mildly. I mean, sometimes some PI who may or may not have been my own, they'll just bully the editor and say, no, this is important and you're going to send it out for review. And they can only do that because they are a big name. So there's something to be said for democratizing that influence on the editors, because, you know, if people are shouting at each other about it, then at least it's important to that group, right? As opposed to just this one Craig Bentner who's saying, yeah, it's important, send it out. And then the reviewers are going to say, oh, well, if they sent it, it must be important. So it kind of like, you know, self-sustaining, and to democratize that, I think, is one of the, again, the positive.
Yeah. Well, I should emphasize, I you know, I have spoken with Craig Bentner on the phone in the past, and I should just be very clear, he is very courteous, and I would not describe him as a bully in any way. But there are people who are like that to editors. And it's one of the things that you always say to budding editors and people thinking of it, is that, you know, this is one of the, you are saying no to a lot of people. You know, if you're a Nature editor, most of the time you're giving disappointing news to people, and they, a lot of them don't like it. And, you know, people can be incredibly aggressive in that, and those scenarios. And sometimes you do get the, do you know who I am, comes up in the call. I never have actually said that, but in the back of my mind, I always think, I do know who you are, and you're lucky that's not influencing my decision. But
yeah, to be clear, Craig Bentner is not like a bully. I want to get out there too.
as a former geneticist, I can say that I fully appreciate the impact that Craig Bentner has had on the field. So we'll just make that clear now. I have two things that are not really related to how we've been flowing this conversation, but I think need to be brought up, and I'll put my person who asked the naive questions hat back on. But I think we need to talk about the funding behind all of this, because we know that BioArchive, you know, obviously has been generously funded by Cold Spring Harbor and the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. And if I don't have that right, please correct me. But somebody's paying to host these papers and paying to vet them in the way that they are vetted. And we know that there's a whole funding apparatus behind and for-profit apparatus behind the traditional journals that is, you know, maybe a little undesirable in certain situations. So what do you, you know, if you're willing to sort of opine on this situation, how is this going to move forward? Like, what if that funding that's backing BioArchive disappeared, or what if it's not available to a certain field? How does this work in the future?
No, I think that's a very good question. It's something we think a lot about. I mean, I guess the first thing to say that's really important is, in the grand scheme of things, it's not very much. I mean, it's the number is, you know, it costs millions of dollars each year to run these things, but the scientific publishing industry is a $10 billion a year industry. You know, the APCs for a journal article, which to some extent reflects cost, one could argue about that all day, you know, are in the region of sort of $3,000-$4,000 to $10,000 a paper. There are 2 million papers published each year. You know, that's how you get to a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar industry. The costs of hosting a preprint are tens of dollars, not thousands. So the logic I always say is that, you know, it's the research costs hundreds of thousands. The journal article costs thousands. The preprint costs tens. So I think it would be a terrible failure of the scientific community if we cannot find tens of dollars for papers. It really is, you know, the change found at the bottom of the sofa in the grand scheme of things. So the question is, you know, how do you get the tens of dollars per paper to allow you to do this responsible screening and permanent hosting and all the features of BioArchive? And right now we have generous funding from Cold Spring Harbor and Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. And I think going forward, we want to diversify that, have more folks contribute. Personally, it makes far more sense to me to have, you know, a relatively small number of groups that represent the scientific community writing large checks, rather than trying to administer, you know, sort of hundreds of thousands of payments of tens per dollar. I mean, we don't want a kind of like a customer facing thing where you have to pay to put your paper on BioArchive. We never wanted that. The whole point is that it's free to read and it's free to post. And we think that that can be done because the total cost is relatively small in the grand scheme of things. You know, if you are a funder, the scientific ecosystem is funding billions of dollars for publishing, and, you know, sort of tens, hundreds of billions of dollars for all the research. So we ought to be able to find that and get a group of funders to say, actually, you know, we can earmark this very small amount of money, relatively speaking, to fund this. I think, you know, there's then another question about the whole peer review process and what that looks like. But, you know, the nice thing about having the kind of preprint ecosystem is that you can take care of that sort of infrastructure piece of the papers. And then have a conversation about how you fund peer review, how it evolves, as we discussed before, and who pays. And that's not constrained by having to cover the hosting of the paper online as well.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think I'd add that, yes, the APCs are funding this multi-billion-dollar industry, but also the subscription fees. And, you know, I think a lot of people in the academic world probably just, well, I don't know, I want to make the assumption that they just assume that those are paid by somebody because their institution is paying for it. But coming from a small to medium-sized biotech world, you know, we don't have that access anymore. As soon as you move into the for-profit world, you no longer get those academic subscriptions. And really, I would argue that science is moving forward with startups, you know, at this point. And startups can't afford to have the subscription fees also go up when you're not an academic. So to have subscriptions to these journals, and that's, you know, coming back to open access and the discussion around open access and who pays, but I think we need to really, as a scientific community, do some thinking about how science is accessed and who's paying for it and who's benefiting from it, how that money gets distributed.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I mean, you know, you're totally right. I've heard this from a number of small organizations, biotech, that they can't afford the subscriptions. I mean, the flip side, of course, is that people in the nonprofit sector will say for-profits should contribute in some way. So, I mean, it would be nice if there's some way to contribute without it being this huge amount. I mean, you know, a small biotech company cannot afford to have all the subscriptions that Harvard does, which will have a multi-million dollar library budget.
Absolutely. Okay, we're coming to the end of our time. I would love to give you the opportunity to, you know, is there anything we didn't touch on? Anything that you would like to share with the community about, you know, what's going on in your mind, what, you know, as you live and breathe this world, what, any last words?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the one thing I would, I always want to underscore is the value of all this for early career researchers. And I think there's a lot of, you know, and I think, you know, back to that kind of hyper-competitive prestige economy, that's all kind of fueled by the labor of young scientists who are in very sort of precarious positions career-wise. And I think it's preprints afford all sorts of opportunities for them. They can get their work out more quickly. They can get that new job more quickly. They get exposure that they're in control of the timing of. And also because of this sort of evolving phenomenon of people doing peer review of preprints, there's an opportunity for a lot of early career researchers to get involved in that. And I'm particularly enthusiastic about that because, you know, I was one of those people many years ago who chose not to go on and become an academic. And then you go to a job interview and they say, okay, well, what can you do? And you say, well, you know, I can run STS page and I can sequence stuff. And, you know, I'm not going to be doing that in my new job. And, you know, and here I've got a PhD thesis that you're not going to read. And it would be kind of nice to have a bunch of other things, a bunch of peer reviews that I had and I could make public and I could say, hey, look, you know, I read across all these other fields, you know, I can talk about other things. And I've always thought that this whole notion of preprint peer review is something that is of a lot of potential benefit for young scientists, those who are going to stay in science and those who are going to move out of bench work as well.
Accessibility across all sectors, you know, of who can contribute to science and who can who gets a seat at the table. I think that open access is one of the keys to providing that. Daylon, any final words from you?
Well, just following up on that thought, I mean, I would just say, not mission accomplished, but you've certainly normalized the idea of preprint. And when I was a trainee, it would be like confusion, you know, what? You want me to just share the work? And I think that nowadays it's almost implicit that while waiting for the work to reach a point of maturity, that it's not going to bounce around in review forever after the preprint. It's important to get it out there for your own benefit and particularly to the benefit of young scientists. I mean, I think that's the thing. Any resistance comes from these legacy scientists for whom this whole notion of, you know, getting scooped in prestige journals and hyper-competitive economy is baked in. So yeah, it's going to take this younger generation of scientists to change the paradigm. And I think the really important step that you've made in the past decade plus, whatever it's been, is that, yeah, there's zero resistance to the idea of preprints nowadays, which I could have never predicted. I would have never predicted that in such a short time, people could have such a different notion of that when it's like a going from self-preservation, looking over your shoulder to like a open science economy. I wouldn't say we're there yet, an open science economy, but at least it's not anathema.
Congratulations and thank you. Thank you for making your impact and doing what we all thought was impossible, which is shaking up the publication industry and making things more accessible. That brings us to the end of our episode. Thank you so much, Dr. Richard Sever. Please, everybody, check out his recent paper in PLOS Biology and find him online. There's a few other talks that are really fascinating, and we really appreciate you being here today. Okay, that brings us to the end of our show. Don't forget to sign up for our email list at www.labcoatsandlifepodcast.com to get show notes, episode summaries, and links to useful information, or learn more about STEM mentorship via the resources at www.stemcell.com/labcoatsandlife. You can also reach out to us on Twitter via stemcell at stemcelltech or via email at info@labcoatsandlifepodcast.com with feedback or to suggest guests.